Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk. What do we do that? It's the weekly podcast for people who play with needles.
That's correct.
That's what it is. Yep. And our guest this week, our guest this week is one of the great needle players of all time, Mary Corbett. Mary, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Christine. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, that's our new slogan. Actually, I think I'm going to change that on the website.
I think you should.
Weekly podcast.
Did you know that there's not to put a damper on anything, but did you know that there is a blog that's called Plays with Needles?
No.
Oh, Gary.
Man. Oh, there is. Sorry.
That's good to know. See, now you've just, yeah, there's going to be days of sadness now.
I'm so sorry. Susan Elliott is the author.
All right, so I'm going to have to call Susan. You know, when we were putting this together, that was one of the hardest things was, what do we call this thing?
Because
you couldn't get a URL for anything that has to do with needle, thread, or anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're all used. So that's why the URL is different from the show name, We Talk Fiber, because we just couldn't get them. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're good, though. I like Fiber Talk, and then We Talk Fiber goes really well with it. So
kind of works.
Yeah.
We'll work it out. Figure it out as we go. We can figure out a new slogan, Gary. I have good confidence in you.
I'm really sorry.
No, I think it's really funny. And I think now that you mention it, I'm pretty sure that I've seen that before, too. And I just hadn't made the link because I've been sort of resisting Gary's need to call this the podcast about people who play with needles.
Yeah. It's that double meaning.
Yeah, we may have to find a way. We'll work it out.
I'm currently in a corner in the fetal position, so leave me alone.
Oh, you'll get through it.
Yeah.
I think so. Well, a little bit of therapy and we'll be fine.
Yeah. Again. Okay, so Mary, I have to tell the story about how I encountered you the first time, because I looked it up. It was February 2013 was the first time I encountered you.
Wow.
And I was looking, and I've been religious reader and follower ever since. Like, I don't think I've missed a single blog post or anything.
Oh, wow.
So I was searching, and I remember distinctly doing it. I was searching for needlepoint, charts, patterns, whatever, for Easter eggs, because I wanted to stitch a stand-up Easter egg.
Okay.
And you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
And so I'm searching for this, and there's this lady, Mary Corbett, who is blowing the albumen and yolk out of eggshells, out of eggs, and drilling them and stitching them. And you had me. I mean, you just had me.
Yeah, it's kind of a tedious process.
I can imagine. But yeah, Christine, so you can look on her site there. She actually, you got it figured out pretty well, and how to, you got that so you could drill them and stitch them, and you actually got something to work. But following that, I was hooked forever.
Well, the funny thing about that is that what I wanted to do there was actually stitch the eggs without having to cut a hole in the back of them.
Yeah.
Because I'd seen that online where people were stitching eggs, but they were cutting a big hole in the back. And I thought, well, I know that they do this without cutting the hole, but how do they do it? So that was kind of fun.
Yeah, because I was always going to write and ask you, but I never got around to it, and then it just went away and became a non-thing. But
yeah.
So basically, when you stitched that, you drilled the holes and figured out a pattern. Inside that egg, then, you had like a laser security thing of threads going across the egg, right?
That's right. That's right. And I learned a good lesson. After you stitch it and you've passed back and forth inside the egg a lot, you create some real tension on that shell.
Oh.
And the shell is weakened because of the holes. And so you can't. You have to be really careful when you're holding the egg and handling it, But then on top of that, you can't drill it again.
Oh, that's it, huh? Oh.
Yeah, because I tried to go back and put another hole in on one egg that was almost finished, uh-huh. and I didn't even think what I was doing. And, of course, the drill goes into the middle, and it catches all those threads.
Oh, no.
And it just, the whole egg implodes.
Just explodes.
No, it implodes.
Well, yes. So what kind of a drill were you using? Just a very, very fine tip drill bit on a regular drill?
No, it's a Dremel.
A Dremel?
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense. And so you have to really plan the entire thing out perfectly beforehand because you have no opportunity to make any more holes once you start.
That's right. you can't erase them.
Yeah.
No. Toothpaste.
The funny thing about the Dremel is, you know, I was kind of excited because I was finally learning how to use this power tool, you know. and the next year I went back to revisit the whole idea of embroidering eggs, and I couldn't figure out how to put the Dremel back together.
Oh, no.
So I actually had to call my nephew and say, could you explain this to me? Oh, well.
Well, I tell you, what was the egg that you ended up, because you tested different eggs, duck and chicken, and what was the one you ended up was strongest?
The goose eggs and the duck eggs are the strongest.
Yep. Oh, okay.
Yep. And the duck eggs are beautiful. They have such a, they have a very smooth shell, and they're almost like a fine porcelain or something.
Oh.
So they're really nice. Huh. But yeah.
Well, that was, yeah, that's what, that hooked me. That hooked me on needle and thread. I subscribed and follow you. I get you on the Feedly news feed and,
okay. Yeah.
So every post.
Well, I'm glad.
That was what tripped me.
Now I'm imagining though, what else could you do with this technique, right? Of drilling. So now that you've moved off canvas, and you've moved off of something two-dimensional. There's so many things you could do.
Oh, sure.
Right? I mean, an egg is unique because it's really tricky because of just the fragility of the surface that you're working on, right? But, I mean, my goodness, you could do all, I mean, wood seems to be the most obvious thing, but you could really embroider anything, couldn't you?
That's right. And I think you can embroider anything, but then at what point does, if you just consider embroidery as decoration, then it's still all embroidery. But if you get down to the traditional meaning of how we conceive embroidery, then you're kind of getting into a different type of art. It's still embroidery in a way, but I don't think it's quite the same.
So where would you draw the line then? Where does the definition fade for you?
I think it's okay to embroider anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But.
But you really kind of, you enter the gray area at least once you leave a basic ground cloth of some kind.
Yeah, I think so. Perhaps. Yeah. Well, have you seen the fences that people do?
Yes.
The chain link fences and stuff? I think that's interesting. I think it's pretty. But would I call it embroidery? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. Right.
Yeah.
I think that's a good line to draw. Right.
Yeah. To me, that's just a yarn version of putting paper cups in the holes.
Right.
Yes.
it doesn't do it. So, yep.
It's yarn in a grid, but it's right. I agree. I don't know that that's embroidery.
Right.
Yep. Okay, so what are we working on? Christine, are you still knitting that hat?
Yeah. Working on hat. I've had a very stressful work week and things have just been a little hectic for me. So I've just been, you know, so there's times where a project, a very, very challenging project is good. And there's times where a project that is completely mindless is good. And this is one of those times. But that said, I finally got the chart for Debbie Riley's Debbie's Delight 10.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh.
So congratulate yourself, enabler.
Oh, I'm sitting up proud now. I've left the fetal position. I'm sitting up proud. Yep.
Yeah. So I have to probably this weekend go and source yarn to be able to start that. So that's where I am with that.
All right. Another one. We captured another one.
Well, I had to start somewhere, and I was very disappointed because there was another chart of hers that I tried to order that was, I just couldn't get my hands on anywhere. And I think it was called Black Magic. Do you remember that one?
Yep. Yep.
So I wasn't able to get that one, but I'm going to do this one. So of course, you know, me being me, I chose, you know, the easiest embroidery, needlework thing that I could find to start with.
Yeah, no, you didn't.
Because I haven't done any sort of, needlework or cross stitch or anything since I was about 12. So, right. So I'm going to ease myself in, and it's going to be great. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, no quicker way to get the training wheels knocked off than to dig into a Debbie Raleigh design.
No. Gary knows I'm being very sarcastic. And so I'm excited because what I'm expecting is a chart and what I'm getting is a manual. And that is very exciting for me because I'm going to learn a ton from it because there's all kinds of stitches and techniques and things that I've never done before. So it's really going to be great. And it may come out absolutely terrible, and that's completely okay because it's, you know, I one day I will tell you the story of Gernard the Ugly Snail. It's a story I've been saving. But I'm not afraid to have something come out absolutely terrible. If I'm trying something new, a new technique. So it may come out terrible, and that's perfectly okay with me. So that's okay. What I'm going to be doing.
So Debbie, she listens. Debbie, who has that other chart Christine needs? Somebody has it somewhere.
Yeah, I have to find it because I really, really, really want to stitch it.
Yep. What was it called?
I think it was called Black Magic. It's the only very asymmetrical black background one, and we talked about it at length, so.
Okay. All right.
So we'll find it.
Need an assist here, Debbie.
Yeah. And it's right, quite the opposite of the other one that I got because the other one is all, you know, pale blues and ice colors and glitter and so it's going to be kind of neat.
Yep.
And it's on did you say it's on a black background?
It's on a black, right. It's on black canvas.
Okay.
So yet another challenge. Exactly. Yeah. I know.
Mary just cringed for you.
Yeah. Yes, I know. I know. We talked about that at the beginning too, so that's okay. Yep. I'm not afraid to tear things out and start over. That's fine. That doesn't frustrate me.
Okay.
Good.
All right. I'm still on Lady Edith's Gay Ann Rogers Lady Edith Geometric. I'm locked into it. Normally by now I'd have switched off to something else and something else and come back to it. But I'm just locked into this. This thing is, I'm really enjoying it, so I'm probably going to ride it to the end now, but it's a beautiful chart and a nice little challenge and some different stitches. So enjoying that. Yep. So Mary, you're always working on like 20 things. Are you doing something for fun, or is everything for work?
Everything I do is for fun.
Oh, okay.
And it just so happens that it's all my work as well.
Okay.
So I've got a gold work project going that I haven't shown on the site yet. And I framed that up a couple weeks ago and I've actually got some stitches in it, which is a good thing. So that's going on. I'm working on another monogram alphabet and I have a 15 minute project. That's what I call it. It's a 56 count silk gauze project.
Yeah, I like your approach to that. I think that's an excellent approach for something like that.
Yeah, because I keep it set up and then whenever I have time, downtime, or I'm in a waiting pattern or anything like that, or whenever I have so many things that I have to do that I'm not sure what to do next, so I just say, oh, well, I'll go work on that. You know? So I like that kind of project because first of all, it's not mine. So I don't have to think about it.
Mm.
and I don't have to select colors. I don't have to think about stitches. And even when I get to that really tedious, the background, because it's a lot of teeny tiny tent stitch.
Yeah.
You know, in the same, in the same colors, you know.
I'm falling asleep.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Right.
But when I need to think, it's a good thing because I can do something with my hands and I can really think about things and, you know, work my way through problems mentally or whatever because it's mindless, you know?
Right. Right. How is that gauze to stitch on?
It's a lot like, well, it's a lot like mono canvas, except it's really teeny tiny.
Oh, okay. So really not any different, just.
Yeah, it's not any different at all.
No. Now, do you break down and use a magnifier for this?
Actually, no.
You're incredible. I can't believe it.
No, it's not. It's not because I have great eyesight. It's because I have awful eyesight. So, I actually have to take my glasses off. Yep, and stitch really close to it.
I do exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Well, it's more comfortable.
My eyesight has done exactly the same thing where isn't that weird? And I'm trying to figure out how that all works. So you have regular eyesight and then you get bifocals and then it gets to a point where it's easier to see with no glasses at all close up.
Yeah. I have, I'm nearsighted anyway, and I have been all my life.
Me too. Right.
So I hit 40 and my eye doctor said, oh, you'll need bifocals. And I said, why? And he said, well, you hit 40. I
said, that's not a reason.
And I hadn't had glasses. I hadn't had an eye exam for about 5 years. And he was right. I needed bifocals. Mm-hmm. So, then with my last eye exam, my eyes had changed a lot in the last year and a half. And, with the new glasses, even with the bifocals, I'm hopeless when it comes to detailed work. So I found out I can just take them off and I'm fine.
Yep. I'm the same way. So I can read okay with glasses, but then if I want to read anything really, really small or do any kind of needlework, even knitting, like I'm sitting here knitting now, and glasses come off and it's the easiest way. I can't see anything else beyond about 12 inches in front of me.
That's right.
I have to say, because there's really nothing beyond 12 inches in front of me that I need to know. So it's all good.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. That's an amazing thing. Cause my wife has terrible eyesight too. Like take her glasses away and she just freaks out because everything is just so messed up for her. But then whenever she has to do close work, off come those glasses.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that? You can't see. I mean, you can't even walk across the room without your glasses.
Nope.
And then she takes them off to do that, and she's just fine. Yeah. So yeah.
And it's perfect, and it's almost a relief at that point because you spend so many years struggling to see, and then just to have one moment of relief of
that's right
ability to see. Right. You just
Yep. And it's comfortable.
Yes, you know? It is comfortable.
So.
Yeah. So okay. So gold work. That's the other thing that fascinates me about what you do, your ecclesiastical stuff and then gold work. Mm-hmm. I mean, that stuff is amazing to me. Is gold work really more challenging than working with normal threads? It just looks like there's some different angles to it, I guess.
Yeah, I think that, I think people think that it's a difficult technique because I guess because of the expense of it and because the whole look of it, it's very rich.
Yes.
But it it's not just between you and me and the wall. It's not hard.
No.
No, it's I don't want to say it's all froth and bubble, but it's exacting, but there are no difficult stitches in gold work, really. You're couching and you're cutting some of the gold work threads and sewing them on like beads. So it's not that difficult.
Yeah. Cause that's, there is a lot of couching, and I mean, that's mm-hmm. That's a real talent. So it doesn't look like it's all cushioned.
Right.
You know, there's some care there. And I love the one that's like a twisted spring where you separate it out and then couch in between.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, but yeah, is it a pearl something where you take chunks and stitch them down like beads?
Pearl or, Freeze Brilliant or whatever. It's a spring. It's a tightly coiled spring. It's a wire, you know, that's tightly coiled in a spring. It's very bouncy. And then if you pull it apart, it's not going to bounce back.
Yeah.
So you don't want to stretch it. Plus I should qualify. It requires accuracy and it requires a lot of preparation.
Okay.
But it isn't actually hard.
If you do the prep work.
Right. And if you're accurate in cutting the gold threads and in your stitch, you know, and your spacing and stuff like that, you can bunch up the pearls too close or you can cut the thread too long, the metal thread too long and, you know, apply it to the fabric and end up pulling and it'll crack. So you have to take it off and replace it, things like that. So it requires some accuracy and precision, but it's not difficult to do. It's not like taking a stitch, like the plaited braid stitch or something like that, that has a lot of different strange movements to it that you have to work mm-hmm. into a rhythm. With gold work, the stitches are actually very simple. It's just you have to be accurate with cutting and preparing your ground fabric and your padding and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, but something you don't do a lot of it. Maybe you do a lot more than you show, but
I haven't done a gold work project in 2 years, but it's what I always want to get back to.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So that's why I started this project that I'm working on now. And it's hard to tear myself away from it to work on things that I absolutely have to work on, you know?
Okay. All right. Yeah. So it is that much fun then. Okay. Yeah.
I think it is.
Yeah. It's on my list out there somewhere to give it a try.
Well, if nothing else, it's sparkly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Make for a nice ornament type thing, like a small project.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Don't go big on your first project. Just go small.
is it hard to source all the gold stuff anymore?
Well, you know, funny you should ask that. there in the U.S. there aren't too many shops that carry a wide variety of gold work threads. Hedgehog Handworks in California, which is her shop is closing. She probably had the best range of gold work threads, but I found out that there are some other shops now that are carrying them. They just haven't gotten their range up yet. So I think Nordic Needle is carrying them. Okay. Needle in a Haystack in California is carrying them. But I think in North America, Tanya Berlin up in Canada carries the best selection of gold work threads. Yeah.
Okay. So still in North America, we can get some. Okay.
Yeah. And they're the ones that we use here in the West and, you know, the Western world are made, I think, mostly in England, and there are manufacturers too in Spain, and they are still making them, so they are available.
Yeah, and you have that unique problem that I think sadly is getting to be a problem for more people, in that where you live, you're a long way from a needlework store of really any kind. And
that's
so,
right.
Yeah, so you end up having to order online and good thing there's a, an internet to make that easier. But, Hedgehog was closing, and I saw somebody else was closing too. They were simply retiring. And it just kind of brought to mind that, for a lot of people, this is getting to be more of an issue where they just can't get in a car and 15 minutes later be in a needlework store. You have to order online
Well, I think that's been an issue for a while, though. I mean, since the late 90s, even, the shops started closing. And there was the big boom in the 80s of cross-stitch and everything in the U.S. So you would find cross-stitch shops or needlework shops that were kind of ubiquitous. every city seemed to have one.
Right.
But I think in the 90s, the early 2000s, we started to see those shops kind of close up. And then with the advent of the internet, if small needlework shops don't have an internet presence, I think that now they really, they're missing a lot of the business, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. What I'm finding here, because I started looking into sourcing the threads for this new project, is, mm-hmm. Even on Long Island, there's essentially two shops, one very, very far east of me and one very, very far west, and they're never open. Yeah. So it's they're open for a little bit of time on the weekends and during business hours that no one that actually has a job can ever go to the store. So that's becoming an issue too, is I can't even get to the shops, to be able to purchase anything there. And for me, especially for a first project, I want to be able to look and feel and get a sense of the threads that I'm buying, to get an idea of it'd be one thing if I knew what each of these things was going to be before, because for you guys, you've been doing it a long time. And when you're ordering a particular thing, you know exactly what it's going to be like. Mm-hmm. And for me, I want to sort of get the hand of something. And it's going to be really difficult to do that because it's just not available.
Yeah. Hey, how far are you from Pennsylvania? Somewhere in Pennsylvania.
Pretty far.
There's a shop in Pennsylvania, Fireside Stitchery. And it's in eastern Pennsylvania, southeastern, probably down by Lancaster, I think.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just there last weekend, and I probably could have swung through had I known. But yeah, that's probably 5 hours away. So.
Oh wow! Yeah.
Yeah. Not such an easy. So yeah, internet. It's going to be internet for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess the point I was trying to make is, there was that flood. I mean, it was like scrapbooking stores for a while there, where every time you turned around, there was two of them. But now it seems like when a business closes, it's almost a shot to the gut for the hobby because it really is a notable thing when there's just a lot of shop owners that want to retire. They just want to be done and not be in a shop every day. And you can certainly understand that. And then of course, will somebody buy my business? Well, no.
Let me ask you guys. So I'm going to ask all these beginner-y questions. With specialty threads, and I know that the real specialty threads, you're not going to have a shot at. But typical craft stores that lean a little bit more towards the needlework side of things. So here in New York, that would be something like a Joann's Fabric type place. Maybe an AC Moore, not a Michaels, because Michaels is kind of just like a general arts and crafts kind of place. What do you think the chances are of finding any kind of threads besides just the basic DMC colors?
Nil.
Yeah.
pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Figured I would ask.
Yeah. No. They carry DMC. They carry. Like Joann's carries DMC floss, the six-stranded floss.
Right.
And they carry the pearl cottons. And they carry some of their specialty threads by DMC. And occasionally you might see, I don't know if I've ever seen Krynek at Joann's.
I haven't.
But other than that, you're not going to find any specialty threads,
nothing.
Really.
Yeah. Okay.
Nope.
Yeah. And you know, I have Joann's always cheaper. I'm fortunate. I have a good needle point, needle cross stitch needle point store near me. So I'm fortunate. But, the thing with Joann's, and I pass a Joann's to go to the store, and maybe it's just a weird quirk of mine, and I have a couple of those. I don't like buying DMC floss at Joann's, even though I can get it for less, because I'm always concerned about how much it's been handled by every kid that walked by. You know, it's just
that
a thing I have.
Sounds like Gary.
Yeah,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And so if if I go to my favorite needlework store, then they're stored in drawers, and so I know it's been out of the light, out of the dust, all those things. And so it's just a thing I have with DMC floss, so I'll pay more. I like to support the store anyway, but I'll pay more just because then I know that what I'm getting is clean and taken care of. So I just
Right. And I think supporting the store is probably the best reason to do
that. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Oh, good, a train. All right.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No. So, like we were saying before we started, Gary and I have been doing podcasts for many, many years, and trains have been featured prominently for several years, so no issue. Well,
yep.
Unfortunately, the ones in Kansas are usually about 115 cars long.
Yeah. Ours are just passenger cars, so it's pretty brief.
Yep. Up. There it is. Now it's just cars rumbling by, so we'll be fine.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I mean, that's just a weird quirk, but yeah, you're right, Christine. You can't just go to the Joann's. I mean,
No.
And Mary, I don't know about where you've been, but even once you get past the six-stranded floss, even the pearl stuff is pretty limited in what they have to offer.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Yep.
So, no, I'd rather
It's difficult. It's not an easy hobby to enter because it's not like, oh, I want to be a scuba diver. Okay, well, there's 17. Well, maybe not by you guys, but here, there's 17 scuba shops, you know, and you basically just walk into any of them and they have all the stuff and then you just buy the stuff and you go and you do what you need to do. But there's just no place like, okay, now I have a chart. Now I need to get yarn. Okay, now I'm finding I can't get yarn anywhere and I'm going to have to order all that from specialty places. And even ordering yarn, it's, you know, going to be an issue of finding one place that's going to have all of the things, you know. So I can understand why people end up kidding things. It ends up being so much easier to do that.
Right. That's just it. And the other thing, too, is needlework is such a tactile thing.
Yes.
You want to touch it.
Yes.
You know, you want to know what you're going to be working with and you want to touch it. And then when it comes to selecting colors or anything like that, the internet is just not the best way to do that.
Nope.
So.
No, because you need to lay them out next to each other, really, to see how they play. Right. And there's no way you can do that.
That's
online.
Right.
You know, either you have a stash that you can work from or you need to go to a shop and do it. There's really just no way to do it. So I think, you know what I really need to do is I do live next to this giant city. So perhaps I should avail myself of this giant city next to me that perhaps would have, you know.
I think there
and
from what I've heard,
fabric district.
Yeah, that's right. But from what I've heard, I think there's one needle point shop in New York City. Mm-hmm. But I think as far as needlework goes of that kind, there's
probably
only
not.
The one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is surprising because you'd expect there'd be half dozen, but no, I that's the conclusion I've reached. Just people on Needlepoint Nation, for instance, looking for stores is that to go into New York City, you can't just go on a store tour. It doesn't happen. It doesn't exist.
No. And it's different. So if you were a sewer, so if you made, even quilting would be difficult, but if you made any kind of, anything else, you know, decor things, curtains, household items, clothing, you just go into the fashion district and it's literally block after block after block of shops. And, you know, you need buttons, so you go to the 17 button stores that are next to each other. And yeah. it really is that way. Okay, you need Notions. So there's 14 Notion stores and it's in a block and a half space. So it's just an abundance of things of that nature. But once you move out of that into sort of the hobby realm, it just falls off. You're right. There really isn't anything like that. So either you would find it as an incidental in a shop like that, or it wouldn't exist and it would probably be in some nice little neighborhood. I'm probably going to look that up now just to see. Yeah, it'll be in some, you know, cute little neighborhood down, you know, in the East Village somewhere.
I don't know where it is and I don't know the name of it, but I have heard that there's one. So
at least that will be one. So,
yeah. Right.
But to get started on this one, if you're going to use the prescribed colors, just go on Needlepoint Nation and say, I need somebody to kit this up, and about four stores will be more than happy.
Oh, that's a great idea.
They'll put together the kit for you and ship it to you and it'll be all over.
And that's the thing is with a local needlework shop, a locally owned shop, whether they're local to you or online, usually the person who owns the store or who does the ordering is going to be very familiar with the popular designers, and they're going to be able to say, yeah, we know that design. We understand it. What are you looking for?
Mm-hmm. So that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Mary, a question. One of the main questions I wanted to ask you.
Okay.
Is you started out as a teacher, so I relate to you because that's how I started out, but you went all the way to university professor and all that. And the needlework came along and finally overwhelmed you, and so you just kind of broke off and did what you do now. But what fascinates me about you is if you go to your website, there's a page where you show all the different kinds of needlework that you information about them on the sites and stuff that you do. How is it that you just eternally curious and just willing to try anything, or how is it that you,
because
people will tend to specialize and like embroidery, Trish Burr, you know, she's pretty specialized in what she does. It's gorgeous, but you just do everything. What is that, just the educator I want to learn in you?
Probably. It's also, I have kind of a sanguine personality, so I hop around, you know, I like to try different things. So, but mostly it's curiosity, you know, I just want to try it and see if I can do it. And I'll usually give things, a decent enough chance before I say, you know, this is not my thing, or I really don't like this. But when it comes to embroidery, I really haven't run into anything where any kind of technique where I've said, you know, I really hate this and I'm never going to do it again. So, yeah, I'll try anything. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's great. It's really great. And in terms of what you do with your website and your YouTube videos, I mean, anybody who has any interest in anything can go there and at least get started, if not get a pretty good course in how to do really any kind of stitching. So, it's fantastic, but you're just unusual in that way, and it fascinates me that.
I'm kind of unusual in a lot of ways.
Okay.
So I'm glad that's the only one you know about.
Okay. All right. Well. Leave me alone in my little fantasy world. I'll be fine.
That's sorry.
Yep. So, and then the other part, and that, I guess that was after the Easter eggs, the ecclesiastical. You were working on the something Rose, Tudor Rose or something about that time.
Yeah, and it was a Marian medallion, and it had these five Tudor roses around it. Yeah.
Just amazing stuff, and I always wonder about that kind of embroidery. In terms of, do you take extra steps with that with the starting and ending the threads, because it, you know, assuming it's going to get a lot of use, say if it's going to be on a priest every Sunday or every day for some priests, is there a lot of extra care that goes into that to make sure that all those threads don't start to come loose?
They don't start popping off.
Yeah, well you know, because people start using it. I mean, they're used to it and they think nothing of it, and pretty soon it gets draped over chairs and, you know.
I hope not. Well, okay, so that's the thing with ecclesiastical embroidery. It's really any kind of ecclesiastical piece, it's probably not going to be just draped over a chair somewhere or anything like that. They actually have a sacristy where they store these things. They have these flat drawers that they store the vestment in flat, and the drawer closes. And so it's guarded from light and dust, and it's stored flat. So actually they're well taken care of, even if they're used frequently. So I don't worry so much about that, as long as the principal techniques for securing everything are, you know, standard.
Yeah.
I don't do anything extra weird. Although I do sometimes, depending on the piece, I might glue the back of it. So I know glue is a big no-no.
I was going to say, wow, really?
Okay, you have to understand, it's either wheat paste or rice paste glue.
Okay.
And you see it used in Japanese embroidery quite a bit. They'll put a rice paste kind of just very light film where they brush it on very gently on the back of the stitches.
Okay.
And you do that in ecclesiastical work as well. So, yeah. Hmm.
But is this for preservation?
It helps, like Gary said, it helps keep everything secure, but it also adds a certain stiffness to it. For the type of, it depends on what the piece is used for, but for the type of vestment that I was working on at that time, it's a stiff vestment anyway. And so it's okay for the embroidery to be a little bit stiff. And it adds, well, stiffness. I don't know how else to say it, but and it secures it. And I know a lot of people, I've heard a lot of people say, well, you shouldn't use rice paste or you shouldn't use wheat paste because bugs will get to them and things like that. But in most cases, today, we're not in an environment where bugs are, a worry. I would say if it were going to the tropics or somewhere like that, or even to a third world country or something where they don't have pest control, yeah, okay, you might worry about it. But they've been using wheat paste and rice paste on ecclesiastical vestments for centuries, you know? Mm. So
yeah, it's a fascinating end of the embroidery world in that it's, I mean, are there rules and regulations for designs? I mean, how does
it
seems like there has to be some limits. And it's a church, you know. I've done church work. There's always rules.
You don't usually have Elvis on the back of a vestment or anything like that. But yeah. So you have it depends on who it's for, what it's for, but so different churches will have different regulations, but in general, there is a set of ecclesiastical colors, of liturgical colors, and the colors correspond with whatever part of the liturgical year or the feast of the day or whatever. And so you might have, for example, in the Roman Catholic Church, I know that the blue is not a liturgical color, at least in the United States. And so you'll never see a solid blue vestment.
Hmm.
But the adornment, the embroidery and everything on the vestment can be blue. So you might have a white vestment with a lot of embroidery that's blue, but the vestment itself won't be blue. Huh. So there are rules.
Huh. Fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Take us back. Now, you're not the first person that has left a full-time job to move into needlework and make a living and a life out of needlework. Take us back to when you were teaching at the university and stitching, and what was the tipping point where you just said, wait a minute, I want to do this needlework thing, and I just got to break out and go for it?
Well, it was... I don't think it really kind of happened that way. It just became, because I was teaching full time and the blog had grown so much, Needle and Thread had just gotten big. They were both taking up a lot of time, and to keep up with one or the other was going to suffer. Mm. And so I had been teaching for 18 years and I thought, well, you know, if I'm ever going to do anything different, now's the time to try. And I can at least take a year and say, I'm going to see if I can make a go of that. And, I didn't just do it cold turkey. I wouldn't really advise anybody just to say, hey, I'm going to quit my full-time job and, you know, do needlework. The website was already established and I had a lot of really faithful readers, and I made sure that my finances were lined up, that I had no debt, and you know, I gave my job plenty of notice, that type of thing. So I prepared for it in advance. It's not something I just said, you know what, I'm going to do this. Okay. I had to think about it, and it was kind of a precarious step, because when you give up, you know, you're giving up kind of security for the unknown, in a way. And you're giving up not just the, you know, we think in terms of the bi-monthly salary, but it's the benefits and everything else. Because when you go self-employed and you don't have, well, I'm not married, so I don't have any other income source behind me or anything like that. It's kind of a precarious thing. So I was a little worried, but I figured if I was going to do it, it was a good time to do it because I was in the right financial situation where I could afford to. And I just didn't want to give up Needle and Thread, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you started Needle and Thread, did you ever imagine you would end up with a blog and a website and videos that is so content rich? I mean, it's frightening what you have on that thing. It's flat out impressive, but was that your goal, or did that just kind of evolve?
When I started, I was teaching children during the summer for a couple summers in a row. And then I had taken on some adult classes as well, just to teach locals. And my brother just said out of the blue one day, you know, you ought to start a blog. And I said, what's a blog?
Yeah. Question one. Yes.
Yeah. No, I knew because there were a couple blogs that I followed. One was a needlework blog, but there weren't a lot of popular needlework blogs at the time. There were some, but, it wasn't a saturated market or anything. And, I had a little bit of experience with website work. And because of my background in teaching and everything, I have a lot of experience in writing. Right. And so that part just kind of came naturally, but there was a big learning curve there and everything. And when I had, you know, at the end of the first month, I had 17 readers. And I said, wow, I've got 17 readers. I can't believe this. And, you know, I called my brother and I said, I have 17 readers. And he said, readers of what? And I said, my blog. And he said, 17 or 70 or 770. What are you talking about? I said, 17. He said, oh, wow. And I said, oh, that's not very many, is it? And he said, no, no it's not.
Credit to him for being gentle.
I know. And yeah. I was so excited. I had 17 readers. So, and then it grew from there, but really I didn't expect it to grow. I didn't know what people meant by how much traffic do you have or how many visitors a day and that type of thing. So when I had 17, I was pretty excited.
Yeah.
But I didn't say, I'm going to become a professional blogger and blog about needlework and grow a huge blog. That I didn't have that mentality when I started.
Yeah. Okay. 17, you had your own little club.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah. Whoever they are, I appreciate it.
Yeah, I wonder how many are still with you. I bet a bunch of them.
I don't
I
know.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's the fun thing. I think that's the great thing about blogging is that you build a community. And so it's not just me. Needle and Thread is hardly just me. It's everybody who reads and comments and interacts. And we inspire each other. We give each other ideas. And there's always that give and take. It's not just one person. So that's the exciting thing about a blog, I think.
Right. And you do get excellent conversations going on after a post. It's fun to read them. Constructive help, and it's fun.
Yeah, I love reading the comments. And yeah. I don't always have time to respond. And that's one of the things that I regret, you know, is that it is just me. So I have to time myself on how much time I can spend responding to comments, responding to email and things like that. So I don't always have time to respond, but I do read every comment and I enjoy them.
Yeah. It's just neat. It's got to be so much fun to know that many people out there are with you.
Yeah. And it makes stitching much less isolated.
Yes. Yes.
Because I think for a lot of people out there, they are isolated. You know, they're the only person that they know who stitches. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I think that the internet and blogs have changed that for a lot of people, made them isolated people feel like they have friends and they have their own little community. And that's kind of a neat thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a great thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was easier when the culture was such that this was something that all women, you know, because that's how it was, all women learned just as a matter of when you were growing up, you all learned how to do this.
Right.
And that just doesn't happen anymore. So, you know, in the past, women could get together and stitch together because everybody knew how, because they all learned from their parents and grandparents before them.
Right.
And now it isn't a skill that's taught as a matter of course. So, right, you end up just, you know, picking it up because you like to or randomly or so, right, there isn't this just built-in knowledge that you know. Like anybody can get together and have a potluck dinner because everybody knows how to cook.
Right.
This isn't something that you can't do that with this any longer, right?
Right.
So you actually have to make the effort.
But I think that's a really good point. And I think that, that's kind of what's exciting about needlework right now is that it is becoming, it's really enjoying kind of a boom. Mm-hmm. You know, we have more needlework supplies available now than, you know, we've had in a long, long time and more specialty threads, a lot more people interested in handwork. And I think there's a possibility there to revert in a way to something that it's, to making needlework something that you hand down again.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe not to your own children, but to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of exciting because you never know where that'll lead.
Right. Right. And I know Gary and I have talked about conferences and things like that because in our other hobbies, that's been one of the, it's both a unifying thing at the beginning because you, it's a great way for you to meet other people that share a hobby that isn't necessarily the most popular thing in the world. but then it becomes, the conferences become the time where you get to see your friends that you've met through the hobby,
right,
and for years, right? And they become lifelong friends. And then those conferences, in addition to becoming, you know, in addition to being educational and a place where you can see whatever new, you know, supplies are available and things of that nature, that's where you reconnect with people and reestablish your relationship with them every year. So
right.
I think they're critically important in that
and
way.
Go
ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that reconnection, it just kindles your enthusiasm for the
exactly.
whole hobby all over again, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Yep. Yeah, we have done that many, many times. We've been doing this for a long time, and every year we do the same thing. We, you know, right before a conference, we start getting a little, you know, a little sort of lackadaisical about it, and then
mm-hmm.
you come home and you know, you've seen new things and you're excited and you jump back in full force, and then again you're reconnected to other people who are equally energized, and that's what
right.
What drives it back again. So
that's right.
I think that's really a critical part of it to me is that connection. And it's not only the hobby and what you learn and the skill, but it's how it allows you to connect to other people.
Right. Well, I think that's the case with almost any human endeavor, you know,
mm-hmm.
is when it ties you to other people.
Yes.
And gives you something in common, then you know, your enthusiasm for it grows and you spread it around to other people even further. So,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah.
What's a typical day for you, Mary? Do you treat what you do like a job where you try to start about the same time every day and then you just discipline yourself to stop? Do you have kind of a plan each day or do you just wing it?
it depends.
Okay.
So I had some setbacks last year that kind of threw me off my groove, but mostly I rise at a set time and I go to bed at a set time. So I schedule myself, you know, I eat my meals at a set time and I work, I do all my computer work in the morning. So by 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm on the computer and I usually end that around 11, but I break down my computer time into different tasks and then I break for, you know, lunch and household stuff. And then I get back to work in the afternoon, and in the afternoons, I usually will do, I'll either stitch, usually for the blog, tutorials or something that I want to make progress on so I can show it to people and talk about the mistakes I made or whatever. And then, by about 4 o'clock, I finish studio work for the day. And then I do, you know, the whole dinner thing and cleaning up and all that. And then in the evenings, I'll either work on the computer again or I'll stitch for fun.
Okay.
But anything that I'm stitching for fun generally ends up on the website anyway. So,
there is kind of a rhythm and pattern to the day then.
Yeah, I there has to be to a degree.
Okay.
But I'm also very flexible. Things come up. Just in my family, I have a big family, so where there's always something, you know, going on or something spontaneous or something like that. So I'll be flexible, but only within certain parameters.
Right.
And I don't mind saying no, you know, if I have work I really have to do.
Yeah.
Or a deadline that I have to meet.
Yeah, it's just an extra little discipline there when it's just you and you could just put your feet up one day and say, nah, not going to do it. So,
well, actually, I do that, but I don't do that every day, but I do allow myself to do that now and then. to say, you know what, today, and it's usually not the day of, it's usually on Thursday, I'm going to take a break from that kind of thing, or I'm going to go blog somewhere else. You know, I'm going to take my computer somewhere else. I'm going to get out of the house, or I'm not going to do anything that has to do with not needlework, because I usually stitch every day, but I will tell myself, you know, Thursday, I'm taking a day off. Mm-hmm. And so that flexibility is actually a good thing, because it helps me recharge the batteries.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I do that, or some mornings I'll say, you know what? I'm not, I get up at 4:45. So I'll say, okay, I'm not going to actually get dressed until, you know, 8 o'clock or whatever.
That's just crazy.
I know. So I'll do that. But I do find, one thing that I do find is that if I put shoes on, I'm more likely to get work done.
Okay. Yeah.
Honest engine.
No. I had a roommate in college that he would do that very thing. When he had to study, he would literally sit down and put Oxford, you know, lace up shoes on. He would sit down and lace them up before he studied. And we thought he was the weirdest thing on the planet, but he said, no, that makes me sit down and study. Otherwise, he says, I won't do it. Yeah. So I don't think that's so weird. I know one other person.
Yeah. Well, so that's the thing is, though, at home, it would be easy just to shuffle around in house slippers all day or whatever. But if I've put my shoes on, then I know I'm working. So.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. And then your space in the house, I forget, is it the garage you converted, or what did you do?
Yeah. So I have a very small house, a very tiny house. But it has an addition on the back, and there was a garage built onto the addition. And the garage actually ended up being too short. When the contractor built it, it was built just slightly too short to fit a car. And
oops.
So, but, yeah, big mistake. So it's converted into a workroom, and so if you're going into a garage, you know, you're pulling in, and the right and left walls are going to be your long walls, right?
Right.
Okay. So on the long walls on the right and the left are floor to ceiling cupboards that close. So they look like part of the wall, really. And that's where I store my needlework stuff, but I also have all my household storage out here. There's actually a freezer out here and stuff like that. So it's not totally needlework. Mm-hmm. It's household storage needlework because the house is small and there's just not room for anything extra inside. So it's kind of split between the two, but yeah, it's not a cozy, beautiful space. You know, I see other people's workrooms and I'm green with envy, you know, but it's not bad. And it works well for taking pictures and things like that. I can turn the lights on really bright. I have a space where I can just take pictures and stuff like that. So that works out.
Yeah. Well, you have a space. You have a space. A lot of people are chair and a table in a corner. So, yeah.
Well, that's right. And I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful to have the space.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
Right now it's a mess, by the way, but.
Yeah. You claim that. You seem to ebb and flow between mess and, all right, I took a day and cleaned up the mess.
That's right. Well, right now it's a mess.
Okay. Well, you're entitled. Nobody's checking on you.
Yeah, that's right. It's a good thing this isn't a video.
Yeah. All right, we need to get to your recommendations, but I have one more question for you before we do that.
Okay.
That runner, the red work runner, the table runner, that took forever. I swear I was going to get in a car and come finish it for you.
Yeah, I wish you would have.
Because... It's like, really, Mary, you know, sit down and finish it, will you?
I know. It did. It took
so
forever.
Does it get used? The question is, does it get used?
It's been used twice.
Oh, okay.
It was out at Christmas this year, and it was out again. I think it was out last year. I think I had it out for a little bit last year for something or other. And then it was used at Christmas. And then actually I put it out on Valentine's Day on the table. I don't know why. And then I put it back away again.
Okay. Okay. Christine, it's beautiful. It's long, isn't it? I mean, it's a long runner.
It's actually not as long as it looks. It's,
no?
It's about, I think, 46 inches.
Okay. That's pretty, yeah. But it went on forever, Christine. It'd pop up on the website just every now and then. I could almost feel like she felt guilty she hadn't worked on it.
Yes, it was. It was the whole time. It was like a guilt trip. Every time I looked at it.
Yeah. Okay. I was glad when you got it done because I was ready to look. I'll stitch it. You go do your other stuff. I'll finish it for you.
Well, the thing about it is it was a relaxing enough project because, again, it was just held in hand. I didn't have a hoop or anything. And it only had 2 stitches in it.
Right.
So that was part of the problem. It just wasn't very exciting.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't feel like, oh, I can't wait to get back to that. I can't wait to get back to that. So it did drag out. And then I had so many other things going on at that time. But, yeah, it was.
Okay. I just had to know. Had to know after it was finished what the life was like for the runner. Yep. Okay. Recommendations. You have recommendations for us?
I do. Well, they're kind of general.
That's okay.
The first recommendation that I would make to anybody who's starting stitching is to make sure that you have good lighting. And good lighting does not have to be expensive. And I know a lot of people say, oh, I'm not going to invest in a task light because what if I don't stick with embroidery? You can use a task light for anything. It doesn't just have to be embroidery. And I think that I get a lot of emails from people saying, what type of magnifier should I get because I can't see my needlework? My first question is always, well, what type of light do you have?
True.
And they'll say, well, I just use my living room light. Well, get a light, and I bet you won't need a magnifier.
Mm-hmm.
So get good lighting. And the second recommendation is a floor stand. I like the Needlework System 4 with the frame clamp because it pretty much works with any kind of frame that I use, and I can even use it with a hoop. And it makes all the difference in the world to have both hands free when you're stitching.
Okay. Yep, it does. I use a stand, too. Yeah, I can't imagine not using one. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. And then a really strange product recommendation, especially this time of year as we're ending winter. And I wrote about this not too long ago because I'm getting a lot of email about it. People are writing about their hands, especially if we're working with silk, and their winter hands are snagging on their threads and stuff like that.
Yep.
So, I recommend UB hand cream. I sound like an ad, but it's called UB, YUBE, and it's a Japanese hand cream. And you put it on at night, and when you wake up in the morning, your hands are just baby soft.
Oh, you do it at night. Okay. And you did kind of go into announcer voice there just a little bit.
I did.
So that was a nice touch. Yeah.
I didn't practice that. It just comes naturally.
UB hand cream. So that's interesting because I knew I'd forget the name. Farmers, what is it?
Bag Balm?
No. Oh, I knew I'd forget the name.
Norwegian Formula?
No. It'll come to me after we're done.
Corn Silk or something?
Corn Huskers. Thank you.
Corn Huskers.
Yeah, I use that, but I put it on. I never put hand cream on at night because I have winter hands too, and I'm doing This one I'm doing right now is all silk, and yeah, I have to I have to put on the corn huskers because yeah, you snag the heck out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I have to try UB.
Yeah, it's kind of it's pricey, but a little bit goes a long way.
Okay, do that announcer voice again, will you? That was really good.
It's pricey, but a little bit goes a long way.
There it is. There it is, folks, right there. I have a recommendation from you. That I learned from you. I learned a lot of things from you, but one that I learned is to get a good hoop. I never had owned a good hoop till I read you did an article about what a good hoop was and what brands you recommend. Mm-hmm. Get a good hoop and wrap it.
Yeah.
What a difference. Because I'd never done both. I always just, you know, Joann Fabrics, get a hoop. What difference does it make? I always used a wood one. I tried some of those plastics. I didn't like what they did to the fabric. But no, when you read that, I ordered hoops actually from Hedgehog. Ordered hoops and then wrapped them just as you demonstrated. And, oh, what an incredible difference. Changed everything for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about it is once you've wrapped them, they're wrapped for life. I mean, you don't have to rewrap them every time you use them.
Right. You know? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that, of all the things I've learned from you, that one stands out every time I pick up that hoop. It just such a difference maker. And that the ground cloth stays taut. And it's just, what a difference. And really not a huge expense, for a good hoop and not a whole lot of effort to wrap it. And
yeah. Well, good. I'm glad.
I mean, it's just simple thing, just a simple thing, but it just changes the game. And really appreciate that. Yeah. That's a good one. Yep. All right, Mary.
Good. That makes me happy.
Mary, it has been an absolute treat. Thanks so much for making time with us.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I love your podcast, actually, so I hope a lot of people listen to it. Yep.
Well, thank
Great
you.
Great fun.
All right.
Well, pass the word.
Oh, I definitely will.
Even though we can't call it anything with people that use needles, because
Gary.
Sorry. We'll have to come up with something else. We'll take suggestions, so.
Yeah. Hey, that's a good idea.
Yeah. All right, that's going to be it. That's Fiber Talk. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you very much.
Take care.